Thanks, Alex. Last time I was speaking mostly about issues of government funding, and today it's much more about where does private health insurance fit in. Look, there's a lot in what Michael Armitage has just said. I always get annoyed by the public media push whenever the premiums for private health insurance go up, even though it hurts my pocket, because it never compares to your costs, but nor does it compare to Medicare's costs. Medicare costs are going up at a rate of faster than GDP per capita. Now, if that's what's happening, we should use that as a benchmark for private health insurance, but we never do. But I also think that private health insurance has moved on some way since I first was dealing with the industry in 1996. I remember my first meeting with the industry in Sydney, and I talked about the management of risks and how the health insurance industry had to move on from thinking about risks as our costs go up, therefore our premiums must go up, to how do you manage the health risks that are driving it. At that time, I don't think there was anybody in the room who had the faintest, foggiest idea what I was talking about. It was just like a room of the White Shoe Brigade that you might have met at the Gold Coast. Never mind. I think things have moved on quite a way since then. But private health insurance is still probably the most disputed area of where it fits into the health system amongst all the experts and commentators. And that's because the argument isn't one primarily about facts and evidence, it's one about philosophies. There are major philosophical differences, and there always will be. You can think about these as that what is your view of equity and choice, and how important are the two, and how do you balance them? The Canadian view is probably the most extreme view on this. Their view is that everybody should be on the same queue. You should not be allowed, even using your own money, to jump that queue under any circumstances. You're all in it together, no other way. There is to be no private funding of Medicare arrangements. That view is enshrined in their Medicare principles, but it's coming across some pressure because the High Court over there has said this is all very well, but that puts a hell of an onus on the quality and access in that system, and if you're not meeting that, can we really sustain that that is legally allowed, that you cannot go anywhere else? Of course they do, they go across the border. The UK view is that you can opt out of the NHS, but if you opt out of the NHS, you pay the full price. So that if you decide to go to a private hospital, you will not get any subsidies, you'll pay for that totally on your own. The traditional Australian view, it's not a new one, it's been one we've had for many, many years, is that if you decide to go on a private arrangement, in a private hospital, through private insurance, or on your own, we expect to get some part of the subsidy that you would otherwise have if you'd been on the public system. We used to have it through bed subsidies for private hospitals, and we've had it through some one form or another of subsidies for private health insurance ever since. And the argument is that we mightn't give you the full subsidy you would have had on the other system, but we'll give something towards that if you decide to opt out, recognising that you've reduced the costs elsewhere. The US view is further a step again. Basically, it says only the private health insurance, that is for the under 65s, you only can get through private health insurance. There isn't other subsidies other than some form of tax subsidies available. I strongly suspect that the Australian traditional view will be even more firmly entrenched because Australians are going to keep on demanding more choice. But they still want equity. They want to ensure that there is a universal health system that's pretty darn good, but people would have the opportunity, if they wish to pay more, to opt out and get queue jumping or different levels of assistance or whatever. My guess is we've got to design a system which allows both equity but more choice, which allows you to take some of your subsidy and transport it. Right now, if I look at what that subsidy is, and I haven't got my graph with me, but in broad terms, apart from the 30% subsidy, it's a very complex system, because if I'm privately insured, I can still go to a public hospital as a public patient. And so quite a few privately insured people do precisely that. So you've got to add that into what the overall costs are. And if you add all those different elements together, you find actually that the total government support for somebody who is insured is not through the subsidy necessarily for the funder, but the subsidy for the individual who is a member, is more like 70%. Now, I'm not saying that's a bad figure. Indeed, there's an argument that it ought to be 100%, that you should be given your voucher equivalent to what the Medicare premium is, and you should be able to go to your insurer of choice to manage that on your behalf. But that's basically the system, is about 70%, but it's hugely complicated. Apart from these philosophical arguments about where it should lie, there's the argument about, is private health insurance more efficient? Now, the evidence on that is, in fact, highly mixed. There are certainly major efficiency gains from competing providers. So if you've got competing hospitals, you actually get substantial gains in efficiency. And private health insurance, as a mechanism, tends to support more competition between providers. So in that sense, private health insurance has an efficiency gain. But private health insurance as an efficiency because there are competing insurers is more questionable. There's less evidence of much of an efficiency gain from the competing insurers. One of the reasons for that is actually one of the points that Michael raised, that the private funds find it very difficult to manage moral hazard. That is, moral hazard is what Michael was talking about, is when you've got a third-party funder that is in the interests of the consumer and the provider to actually exploit somebody else paying the bill. And when you've got those providers are highly powerful doctors, that becomes more difficult without some government support to help the private health insurance be able to do it. So that you do get examples in the area of, for example, of stents. It's been very hard for the private health insurance industry to be able to ensure that the use of stents by surgeons is in fact the most cost-effective ones, or hip replacements or other things. And they've turned to the government to try and help them manage that area quite sensibly. Where do we go to from here for private health insurance in our arrangements? Well, just as I think there's a very strong case for a single government funder to overcome the boundaries between the different stovepipes, I think there's some advantages for the private health insurer to take a wider area of responsibility for its members. Why? Because it's likely to lead to better patient care, is the primary reason, because there are many more people who are moving across these boundaries. And also, associated with that, is better allocational efficiency. The current system is hugely complex and has a lot of distortions and a lot of confusions. There's an uneven playing field amongst public and private hospitals for both public and private patients. If you go to a New South Wales public hospital, they will try and talk you into being private, even if it is not in your interests or not even the hospital's interests, because they've got a target for getting some additional funds other than what the government pays. For the poor old person turning up at the hospital, they get all sorts of weird and wonderful advice about what the trade-offs are. We need to get a more even playing field for whether you go public or private and be told honestly what the benefits and the trade-offs are between. But reform is hard while you've got the Commonwealth-state divide as well, because it really does make it very difficult, depending on which state is operating which way or funding their hospitals, how you handle these distortions. In time, what I'd like to see is private health insurance covering all the costs of their members, including NBS and PBS, and the hospital care, whether I go as a public patient or a private patient to a hospital, that the insurer ought to pay for the lot and therefore have interest in the lot in looking after my care. Now, there would be windfall gains and losses out of that if you did it on its own. You'd have to adjust for that to make sure that there wasn't a sudden windfall gain for public hospitals from money from private health insurers, and private health insurers suddenly having a huge bill and having to bump all their premiums up. But in broad terms, that would make more sense if we headed down that route. Eventually, you could think about Scotland's managed competition model, that is the one I mentioned before, where you would get your risk-rated premium from Medicare given to you as a voucher, and you can hawk it round to the insurer or stay with the Medicare system as you wish. There's a lot of sense in that, but you're not going to get it unless you get some of these other steps in the way. Those steps are going to take some time to sort out. So let's talk about the short term. Again, I agree with Michael on some of that, that I think transparent reporting, use of cost effectiveness, smarter techniques and purchasing within private health insurance all make sense. But another thing we need to do in the short term is on the public side. If we don't have a standard system where the public system is buying from public hospitals for public patients on a clear episodic basis, well, we're going to have these distortions in the market. What happens is, in New South Wales, if I'm a public patient, I am a cost to that hospital, but I'm not an income because their budget is fixed. It doesn't matter how many patients they see, they have to report on that, but their income doesn't change on whether I'm there or not. But if I come as a private patient, I'm suddenly an income, but I'm not a cost because I am a cost, but I'm just sort of fitting into their targets. So they've got all sorts of distortions there. If they were actually purchasing, as Victoria does, you start to even this out and you get a more even thing. So another part of the short-term answer is, in fact, the purchasing of care in hospitals for public patients. I'd also like to see us think about whether the wider role for private health insurance could be done, as has come, not only as we've looked at in the last couple of years under Tony Abbott's reforms, but we might also trial a wider scope on that, something to do. But things I don't favour, and here's where Michael and I are going to differ a lot, is that I think the Medicare levy surcharge is a nonsense. It is basically a means test forcing people into private health insurance. It's not an instrument for allowing choice based on what are the benefits and the trade-offs. It is a matter of, if I've got a certain income, I'd be mad not to go private health insurance. I don't get the choice to think about it. And indeed, because I'm forced, the chances are I'm going to take a silly product. I'm going to have a product which has got high front-end deductibles to keep my premium down, and then I'm going to go to a public hospital as a public patient anyway. So I think that the Medicare levy surcharge is, frankly, not the right way to go about sorting out the long-term interests of the private health insurance system. Also, I think that the current the 30% rebate, I've got no major objection to the 30% rebate, but the idea of bumping up the rebate for the elderly when the whole purpose of lifetime cover was to reduce the distortions from community rating systems is crazy. Why should we have a lower price for the aged when they're going to be much more of a cost than the young? Leave it there.